This is KRFC 88.9 in Fort Collins. This program is Another Look, the weekly Monday night talk show about interesting and unusual people, activities, viewpoints, and even places. I'm Mary Jane Ward. My co-host is Jim Hanneberg.
Thank you, Mary Jane. Our guest tonight is Mike Maness, president of EOSS. Mike, welcome to Another Look.
Well, good evening, Mary Jane and Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, maybe you could start off by telling us, what does EOSS stand for and what does EOSS do?
Okay, EOSS stands for, it's an acronym for Edge of Space Sciences Incorporated. It's a non-profit organization that was started down in Denver back in 1991. And we are in the business of launching, tracking, and recovering unmanned high-altitude balloons, which go up to essentially the edge of space, well into the stratosphere, up at approximately 100,000 feet. And on these balloon payload strings, we carry student-built payloads, which are intended to observe what things are like up in that very difficult to get to part of the atmosphere.
Okay, and how big are these balloons, and what's the weight of the payloads that they loft up?
Well, we try to make them as light as possible. We have two principles that we go by when we're doing payload design and when we're trying to guide students in their payloads, and one is called KISS. And I think you've probably heard of that one.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is KILL, which is Keep It Light, Lunkhead.
know why KISS means.
We do have a federal limitation. We're operating in federal airspace. And we operate under a part of the Federal Aviation Regulations called Part 101.
So then you are licensed by the federal government?
We're not licensed, no. We operate under an exempt limit. There's a ceiling that you can fly at which you are treated as no different from a party balloon, and that's why we try to stay.
Oh, I see.
We're not always there.
Uh-huh.
In fact, the one we flew yesterday was a non-exempt flight, and we did have to coordinate with Seattle on that one. But every one of our flights, we always coordinate with the controllers in Longmont, Denver Center, plus the controllers at Denver International if we're flying near their airport, or Colorado Springs, as we did yesterday.
And how big are these balloons?
They vary with the size of the payload that we're carrying up. For a typical student payload, where we're carrying up no more than 12 pounds of total payload, we use what's called a 1,200-gram balloon, and that fills out to about 8 feet in diameter on the ground. It's made of latex, very much like the rubber balloons. And when it ascends to the burst diameter, it's on the order of 32 feet across. And this is visible to the naked eye on a nice, clear day.
Okay.
You speak of students. Whom do you mean when you... Who are those students?
Well, we've flown with lots of different student groups, all the way from a middle school, Pitts Middle School, down in Pueblo, up through college and graduate students at CU. We've flown, actually we did one flight with CSU, a lot of high schools, and other student groups. We have a flight they're going to be doing for the CAP cadets here this fall. So any students that are interested in this. In fact, one of the schools we flew with, Cherry Creek High School, one of our earlier flights, the principal there, gave us a moniker, the Poor Man's Space Program, because we can get those payloads up there and get them back less expensively than you can do it any other way.
Okay, and after the balloon bursts, then the packages come down on a parachute?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay, and what kinds of sensors do you send up?
Well, typically our housekeeping payloads, we've got to keep track where the balloons are, in altitude and latitude longitude so that we can give position reports to the FAA. We can't control where that balloon goes. That's up to Mother Nature. So we have to tell the FAA where the balloon is, and so one of our primary sensors is the GPS receiver. We also measure inside air temperature inside the package to verify that things aren't getting too cold up there, although we know it's not that bad inside. Outside air temperatures and barometric pressure are typical. And then any other payload sensors that the students will fly, they've included gravitometers, photometers. A lot of the student payloads will carry up still cameras. And in the student payloads, they don't have a radio downlink, real live telemetry. They're recording them on little data loggers on board their own spacecraft. The only way they get that data back is when we get the payload back from the field.
Okay. So you sometimes take these pictures from 100,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of things do they show from 100,000 feet?
Oh, the sky is black. You can, if you're looking out towards...
I have a sensation of learning a whole lot of things right now, and I'm just kind of seeping it up, you know. Keep on going.
It keeps me going, too, because there is so much to learn about
this.
And that's, you know, we keep learning. We keep learning on this.
Yeah.
We haven't done it right yet. After 64 flights, things still go wrong.
Amazing.
I think, but to get back to your question, we travel through the tropopause, which is the boundary that separates the air that we live in down here on the surface and where all the weather exists. And we go through this boundary layer into the stratosphere. There's no weather in the stratosphere to speak of because there's not enough moisture to drive it. And another thing that happens going through the tropopause is the temperature hits a minimum. And then above the tropopause, the temperature starts rising again. It was one of the things that we learned. We thought something had gone wrong with our sensors the first time we saw that. But no, that's actually describes the boundary.
And how much does it cost you per flight? And where does the money come from?
Well, we're a nonprofit, and all of our members operate gratis. This is something that we do for the love of it. And I guess each of our members has got his own motivation for doing this stuff. Sometimes I have to remind myself I do it for recreation. Like when I got up at 3 o'clock in the morning in a hangar down in Colorado Springs and it was 17 degrees with 100% relative humidity and ice all over the place.
And you're not getting paid for it in money.
No. We do have to buy the gas. We use helium for our fill gas, and we have to buy the balloons, which are only good for a single flight. For a typical small student flight, that runs around $200.
Mm-hmm.
And we make an arrangement with the school that we're flying for, if we are flying for the school, to fund that, you know, just refund it for us. Of course, some of the flights we do on our own.
Do other amateur groups do the same thing?
Yes. Yes, in fact, one of the amateur groups that's currently active, that's relatively new startup out of Phoenix, was actually started by one of the fellows that started Edge of Space Sciences back in 1990. He transferred down to Phoenix, and I guess he was getting into helium withdrawal and decided to start another balloon group and try to do it right this time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When I was at your last launch down at, I guess it was Windsor, was at this guy's house, and you had this special room in this guy's house that was like mission control. Just what was going on there?
Okay, that's what we call our ground station. And
this is in Windsor now, isn't it?
Well, it's that, and I'm not in Windsor. It's out in the,
in
the country. It's on the road between I-25. It's a road going out to Windsor.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Down on the county road there. It's actually a ranch. Gene Faton is our host there. He's been very generous in supporting our flights. After our first flight, he built a house there, and he built this lovely glassed-in sunroom on the south side of his house, overlooking about an acre of open field. And we call the thing the Strata Ranch because, man, when we go in there to set up our ground station, which where we have all of our computers, for processing the telemetry, the radios for handling the commanding and the telemetry coming down, our reporting for the FAA. It's like going into mission control.
Yeah,
I said, boy, if they give us more comfortable chairs, I'd have to ask for pay.
Yeah. That's great.
And after these balloons burst, how do you find the payloads that come back down?
Well, this is actually something that Edge of Space Sciences is very, very good at.
Could you kind of set the stage of how this happens? I mean, what happens on the ground, and then you send it up, and then...
Well, first of all, before we launch, we have our track and recovery teams deployed out in the field. We've run a forecast of where that balloon is going to go based upon the National Weather Service atmospheric soundings and their upper winds. Mm-hmm. We've gotten very good at doing that forecast. We can usually predict within 5 miles of where that balloon is going to land. We'll send our track and recovery crews out in the field. They'll set up in roughly a circle, some anywhere from 4 to 8 teams around this site with their direction finding antennas. And then after the launch goes off, we call the launch out to the field. They're in communication through a repeater, which we at the ground station can get to. And every 15 minutes, they'll all take a timed bearing and call in their bearings from their positions in the field. And this used to be done manually, but now we do it in a computer. We have their position, their bearing, and we get a crossfix.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any funny or interesting stories about recovery efforts?
Well, you know, one of the very first flight that we did back in November of 1990, there were just two guys who had this idea to go fly an amateur radio TV camera up in a balloon. There's some other fellow out in Ohio, Bill Brown, who's our grandfather of this, had done this. He really is the godfather of this, except we found out that the Finnish had done it 10 years earlier. Something new.
Oh, I see.
It's amazing.
Oh, that was...
Anyway, we went out to this little park out there in Jefferson County and filled a balloon and sent this payload up, and it had the television signal coming down, and it had a little radio beacon to follow it with. And there were a bunch of guys standing around there watching it go up there, and one of them said to the other, said, hey, wouldn't it be neat to go get that thing back? He said, yeah, why not? In the meantime, the balloon is hauling up there at about 1,000 feet a minute, and it was in November when the wind is real strong out of the west. So these guys said, yeah, let's go get some antennas. You know, they went home, get their antennas, and took a look out there where the balloon was going. And says, okay, looks like it's heading kind of east, so let's all convoy up. So about 5 of these guys lined up out there on I-70, and every 5 miles or so, they'd stop, pull over, and they'd get their direction finding antennas out, and they'd track on this thing. And they said, hey, man, I got to due east from here. And the other guy said, yeah, so do I. All these guys had this bearing to the balloon due east, and they're out there on I-70. He says, let's keep going. Wait a minute, where is it? Well, eventually the balloon burst, and it came down, and the signal went away.
Oh, no.
And they had no idea where it was. And they drove around up and down I-70 listening for the signal. They couldn't hear it. Finally, one of the other guys came out of an airplane. And just before sunset, he picked up the signal out by Stratton, just this side of Burlington. And he went in there. He saw the parachute on the ground and talked the guys in. Now, the second flight is when we did this thing about surrounding it,
yes,
and forecasting it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when the balloon rises and has accomplished the height you wanted to go and everything, then it... what happens? The payload comes down, doesn't it?
Yes.
By parachute, you mentioned.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Could you tell us about your last flight?
Oh, that was an interesting one. Now, I mentioned that we do a lot of work with student groups, but since we are so good at what we do, particularly in terms of the recovery, we've been asked by a number of scientific organizations to fly their payloads up there to the edge of space as well. And since our charter is science and education through altitude balloons and amateur radio, and none of us are paid, then it really fits in our charter. The one that we did yesterday was done for National Oceanographic and Aeronautics Administration, Stark Lab out of Boulder, the Forecast Systems Laboratory. They have a project they're working on that would put high-altitude balloons in the stratosphere for a long duration, 6 months at a time, a constellation of 400 of these things, and each of them would carry 800 sounding radio sounds, like that are flown out of airports twice a day in the U.S. But these things could be dropped down into places where no one has ever flown a radio sound, for instance, out of the northern Pacific where there are no weather stations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where our weather forms. Well, anyway, they have got to figure out how to keep this balloon at altitude, and the way they do that is by pumping air in and out of a ballast bag.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we flew that test article with a small balloon and their test pump on there yesterday, and sure enough, that pump just worked like a charm, just like a
perfect
charm. So, in fact, it worked three times better than they were required to be.
Well, that's great. That must have been thrilling to know
you
set out to do that and it was accomplished.
Right. Well, particularly since that was our second shot at it. The first time we had high winds at the launch attempt, the balloon was getting banged around on the ground and it got holes in it and it only went to 30,000 feet, came down all by itself. So that was a mess. And the wind is our biggest hazard.
Both your helper and your hazard, I guess. Without it, you couldn't do it.
Oh, no. If we had no wind, it'd be great. We wouldn't need a recovery crew.
If
there's no wind, we'd send it straight up and come right down and land where we set it off from.
Okay, now, you brought some stuff with you to the studio. Can you describe it for us?
Okay, well, I brought a couple of our tracking beacons here. Now, I realize this is a...
Yeah, this is radio, so describe it well.
Okay. Well, these things are magnificent pieces of aerospace hardware that are homemade.
Great.
In our shop. They're actually made out of quarter-inch matting board that you can get designed for matting pictures.
Yes.
In fact, we got this at Hobby Lobby. We use that and hot melt glue to make the envelopes of these packages. This matting board is actually quite strong. Because the paper actually shear to give some good stiffness to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not unlike a lot of aerospace structural material that uses a honeycomb core and then laminated stuff on the outside, but this is so much cheaper. Inside of this package we have our GPS receiver, a downlink transmitter, and a signal processor for converting the GPS signals into signals that we can listen to on the 140 megahertz amateur radio band. And then there's an antenna hanging off, long antenna that's used for our downlink. And this particular payload flew yesterday, and I think we cut that down at about 78,000 feet. But this has had, 25 flights on it.
And it certainly is a modest-looking article here.
It is. Well, it's pretty beaten up. This thing has gone in Nebraska. It's flown up against the bluffs in Council Bluffs out there. And is Council Bluffs in Nebraska, north of here?
Yeah.
That's it's got its first big ding there. And this other little box we've got is actually brand new. It flew its maiden flight yesterday. And it looks in a whole lot nicer condition, but it does a very similar job.
You know, they're such innocent-looking things.
Yeah.
They are so simple-looking, you know, to a person who has no scientific background at all, which is what I bring to the thing. It is absolutely amazing to hear where these creatures have been and what they've done.
Well, you know, when I get these things back from the recovery crew, like I did this morning, these pair, you know, I kind of treat them generally. I say, these things have been... someplace I can never go.
Yes, that's right.
I can never go there.
What's the connection between ham radio and what you guys do?
Well, it's critically important, as a matter of fact. The only link that we have between the balloon and our ground crew and our tracking crews out there doing our recovery are the radio signals coming off of this. Of course, on a real nice clear day, you can see the balloon before it bursts. But after it bursts, that 5-foot diameter parachute is real hard to see 20 miles away, and that's the kind of altitude we go to. If we want to make things happen, we have to send it up by radio. If we want to see what's happening, for instance, we want to see what the world looks like from 100,000 feet. We do have a television module that we also send up. It shows live TV. And by the way, one of the coolest things that we see on that is we point our camera up. As we're getting up toward the burst altitude, we actually see the balloon burst. It shatters in a million little pieces.
Yeah, that must be thrilling.
Oh, yeah, and you go through in slow motion and you watch this burst take place over 5 or 6 frames. That's a kick. So that's important. Coordinating among all of these fellows out in the eastern plains of Colorado that may be spread out 30 miles, they rely upon amateur radio for that communication. So it's
now these fellows you're talking about, they're all into it just as you are. They're not on pay. They're all volunteers, right?
Some of them are crazier than I am.
Well, I haven't really noticed that yet.
And how many members does your organization have?
I think I looked at a roster the last time. We're looking at about 50 paid-up members. Our membership, when we first got started, we had over 100. And I tell you, getting a meeting place big enough to hold a membership meeting once a month, it got a little bit difficult. Mm-hmm. But right now, we get about 15 to 20 people showing up at our monthly meetings.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is the public invited to your launches?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Sure. Okay. Anything that we can do to interest the public, and particularly students, in any of these technical fields of engineering, meteorology, aerospace, any of these fields, that's really what drives us, and that's our motivation. Is more
How
than just the fun.
How did you ever get into this?
Well, I think I was inspired by the motives that the fellows who started EOSS, and I've been with it since their second flight. When I was a kid, I got into electronics and stuff. I was one of the never got picked for teams when I was in school because I was a klutz, and I still am. But I found I could get my kicks out of the technical fields, and I found mentors who would work with me on that and teach me this stuff, and I'd go off and try it and work, and I'd get praise for it and all that. I looked out today and I said, where are these mentors? Where are these kids going to get their real hands-on experience and their mentors?
Very important role in our communities. Yes.
And I'll tell you, where my reward is, particularly when you go out with a group of students and they see those payloads go up and you hear this great big cheer going on. And then when they get them back,
they're
scrambling across this field, God, they went across a sludge field a mile to pick up their payloads a few flights a couple of years ago.
Let me ask you this. Do you have any girls interested in this?
Yeah, as a matter of fact. We have a number of female members.
I would think so. I know a few women engineers, and I can just imagine, as children, they would probably be interested in this kind of thing. I mean, that's where we'll get some of our women scientists beyond what we have.
That's exactly right. In fact, one prominent lady in this has happened to be Dr. Cecilia Gers, who is the director of this NOAA Gaines program that we flew for. She is the spark plug behind that whole project.
Marvelous.
She's since retired, but she's still active.
Uh-huh.
She's a member of EOSS, very active.
Uh-huh.
She was down there with us in the hangar.
Great.
Sunday night, and she got her ham license.
Wow.
Because she could see the value of amateur radio.
Sure. Uh-huh.
Can you tell us about your website?
Again, you started out the question EOSS. Well, that's our domain name is EOSS.org. We have a website, www.uss.org.
Great. Okay. Well, any other questions for Jane?
Well, I was going to say I'm so loaded with what I've just learned, and I'm just trying to figure out how I'm ever going to be able to manage handling it. The next step for me must be to come to a launch.
Now,
How can I do that?
Well, you guys up here in Fort Collins are lucky because we are going to have a launch out of the Windsor site, Gene Faden's Ranch, on the 19th of April.
Marvelous. You're in time.
Right. We'll be flying, I think, 8 balloon sats that have been prepared by undergraduates at CU. They'll be arriving out there at 7 o'clock in the morning, and we'll be getting them off at 9. I hate those early hours, but we got to go out then because that's when the winds are low.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time. Mike, thanks for being a great guest.
Well, thank you for having me.
I've enjoyed it. To have you. Okay. As I said, I'm going away loaded with new knowledge.
And this program has been another look. Our guest has been Mike Manus. The next show is, I think it's Lex Krause Film Cuts, but I'm not totally sure. This is KRFC in Fort Collins. Our website is www.krfcfm.org.